Okay, what's last but not least tonight then is moving into the life story thing, which is what we're trying to set up for next week, right? What we're going to be doing. So what I suggest is that who's doing that one? Oh, okay, sure. So before we get to it, let's work on Ed's story first and then do that last, and because that's going to set us up for what we want to work on, what we need to do for next week's life story. Okay? So if we pull out what you did for Ed's story. Okay.
This one was supposed to be my mailbox.
Has everyone got this down and wants to get it down?
Did you not get this one?
No.
Because it may...
Oh.
That.
We've copied it. Go ahead.
I think the best way to start this is just to ask each of you to pull something interesting out that you found. Yeah? And if people overlap, just go to the next thing, just pick something else. Just so we can get a list of a kind of representation on here of some of the things we saw in Ed's story.
At the level of theme or concept.
So you went that far.
I tried. I don't know if I actually achieved it or not, but I tried.
Okay. Let's make it fun and let's not specify, okay? If it's a theme or a concept, just what it is, and then we can come back to that, okay, when we start to see.
I've used the word concept.
So have you got a story there to read, at least?
I can read along.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's the first time you're seeing it?
Yeah.
Okay. If you just read through it, just to get an idea of what it is. Thank goodness it's short.
And try not to read anyone markup, because it would probably...
Don't worry, okay? Okay, so who wants to start? Yeah?
Otherness?
Otherness?
Yeah.
Okay.
Physicality.
Physicality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, yeah.
There was a tone of defensiveness throughout the article.
Mm-hmm.
Defensive. Is that narrative tone defensiveness?
Bad narrative tone defensiveness.
Yeah, contradiction would go with that. Contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well. I thought it instead of as contradiction was as contrast.
Contrast.
I thought of it as contradiction.
I'm curious.
You're welcome to read what you mean by that.
No, I'm curious. What did you mean? Self contradiction.
Mm. Just start there though.
I thought the issues involved mainly labeling motivation, habit, stimulation, coping strategies, and escape. I thought you had clear understanding of all those issues.
Okay. I do my own little discursive analysis when you talk. And the key word there was that he understood.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't what he understood. Mm-hmm. He portrayed a sense of understanding what was going on.
Yeah, it's to be helpful in class.
Oh, I do too.
It's kind of like the otherness.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I had the same difference, but then there's also the
this stuff.
I saw a contrast of me versus them.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah, I just call it something different.
How about identity?
Okay.
You didn't get fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's it?
Almost everything's there.
Just a bit.
Mm. What about carelessness?
Carelessness?
The carefreeness?
Call that the
carefreeness. He was not afraid of anybody. He didn't care what anybody thought, right?
To qualify. Qualifications.
Okay.
Memory?
Qualifying is it. Qualifying is it. Doing.
Objectification?
Is it called as an objectification?
Why no?
Is qualification a thing? Like a self-qualification.
Yeah, you mean like...
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean, justification, yeah.
Okay.
Conformity.
Conformity?
Yeah.
Good.
I think would be fascinating to look at all of our interpretations and see which words came up in all of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interested me already is that you've already all opted to interpret right away, right? And isn't that that's what we do, isn't it? Because, you know, I've got things like loneliness, isolation, but I also have a lot of things that are like saying painful, a sty in your eye, a sore thumb, you know, pain.
Because there's the two sides to those, though. There's the physicality of them, and there's the pain or discomfort.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So,
see, I constructed physicality in a very, very different way, and I looked at the internal, external way he was not receding into his own mind, but he was able to create a virtual space in his own mind, which he compared. On a physical level to the external world in which the fellow students were residing in. And he saw that world in his own mind as being physically as real as what was outside him. And that became the center of my entire analysis.
Okay.
One thing I thought interesting was the fact that when he was talking about how he was not treated well, the only example he comes up with is about his teacher. And that tells me that probably he looks, he blames people who are in position of authority more than others in society.
We didn't have authority, did we?
I took a little perspective on embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
He said I wasn't really in class.
Mm-hmm.
He was not receiving any, he wasn't really present inside his body. He was not receiving any physical cues which would reinforce him being bodily present. So there were no brain breaks, no sketch, no mention of any kind of movement or physicality. So he was kind of believing his body by daydreaming as not being embodied, being disembodied.
It could be. I also relates to the notions of what space he was occupying, what position he was occupying, and that in its connotations, but also definitely put embodiment. Very good. Yeah.
Just reading.
Keep going.
Okay. But just skimming through this, rather than conformity, I see more of a conflict in here than anything. Yeah, he's more of a renegade out on his own.
But conformity gets attached, at least in my understanding, to identity.
Or rebellion?
Not necessarily. Rebellion is you're purposefully rebelling against something. If you're a renegade, you're just doing your own thing.
But in a way, he was passive.
Okay.
Because he didn't didn't conform to the norm, but it didn't bother him anything. So
he uses in terms of roles, he uses cowboy or battlefield. Yeah, those don't really strike me as passive.
That's right.
Occupations.
That's true.
Exactly. That's a good point.
Yeah,
beautiful connection there.
He's trying to escape from reality.
Passive, but. But battlefields and cowboys are bringing up a lot of other imagery for us too. And again, one that none of you have really touched on yet too is masculine.
You mentioned those early on in the conversation too. So that seems more top of mind than rambling on and trying to clarify what he just said earlier.
Okay.
Well, he carries forward then cowboys, battlefields, competing.
I think that was true of the idea of being gifted learner, in modern terms.
Okay.
I don't think that existed in his time, but...
Now how much of that can we... This is a good example where I don't know, so I'm going to say, is that moving too far beyond from the text? Can you find...
Well, the connection I made, more than once he tried to disassociate daydreaming with retarded. He's capable of rational thought. Because he justifies the nuns yelling at him when he says that they yelled, but they were nice. I think David, you hear me about cowboy movies with lots of action and battle scenes in the movie that represents his brain seeking challenge and novelty.
Okay.
He recognizes that daydreaming was a strategy when he says it really has to do with how people deal with people around them and their situation. So there are a few educational kind of clues.
Yeah, I would suggest, this is my suggestion, you two argued about, he's certainly setting up a world that he believes is not normal. Mm-hmm. The norm, mm-hmm. maybe a better way of saying it. But whether or not you could go so far as to say he would imagine he's gifted.
I don't think he thinks he's gifted, but I think he probably fits the gifted criteria.
Okay, I'm with you. Okay.
He's certainly coherent.
Coherent, yeah.
And there's a flow. There's a sense of flow through the whole piece.
Yeah, now, of course, let's talk at type 3 for a second with that one, coherent. What does that immediately, what function does that serve in terms of the fact that he's so coherent and he's supposed to be
to prove
retarded.
To people that he's not. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
An insertion of his intelligence.
Okay.
That he was labeled, perhaps, inappropriately.
Okay.
But he in that, in this piece, then he's deconstructing the notion of the power of a label, in that the label automatically has certain connotations to it, and by being able to do something beyond those connotations, he deconstructs that.
Yeah.
I thought something similar to that, actually, because I thought he was coherent, but there were barriers to his being accepted within the circles of school. I didn't really think gifted, but I thought maybe emotional disability or something, social skills, introvert,
yeah, autism, or who knows.
Something, but yeah.
Reminds me of Donnie Darko.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I would say, and again, this varies a lot, depends on your research question, but what you're doing, and a little bit what Cheryl's done, I would caution is perhaps going beyond the data, okay, into the realm where you're making supposition, you know, you're making suppositions beyond the data about what he might have been.
So
we'll never know whether what he was.
So it's not okay to say perhaps.
It's always okay to say perhaps. It would depend on your research question.
That's totally what I would say. I would not say he is gifted.
No, but what I would say to you, if I was your external examiner, I would say, why is it important for you to perhaps that about this person?
So you don't want them.
What is that actually lending to our interpretation? To go that far beyond the data, what is that doing? Then you might have a great argument. You say, well, that feeds right back into my whole argument about how you know, anyone who falls outside of the norm in education is immediately it's kind of that will work against you too, because you went for a label too. I said, you know, why would you attaching one label
so
help us understand this label any better?
So are you saying that bringing in the word gifted is just like a red light or red flag or something? It's like it's meaningless.
It's not meaningless. It's trying to figure out the point at which we start to move what I call beyond the data into and around where we're a little bit too far removed from what's here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Doesn't mean we shouldn't or couldn't or wouldn't want to do it in certain situations. But you want to start to ask yourself, why am I doing? Why am I making this point? Do I need this point? Is it relevant to my question? And can I really back it out? Can I sustain it?
So what about the fact that we know certain things about the way the brain works now that they didn't know about, such as, you know, the brain seeks challenge or novelty,
mm-hmm,
and challenge, and it looks like he wasn't getting that.
Okay.
So is that a more accurate way to discuss that same idea?
More accurate.
Inadequately challenged?
Accurate. What you said is not accurate,
challenged.
So this is not inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
It has more to do with how far removed from.
So any kind of assumptions about why he was data-driven are not appropriate to the piece.
I would say that they're beyond our ability to accurately interpret.
Okay.
If that makes sense, or not, I don't even want to use the accurately. Remember, we had to show credibility in our research. I would have trouble backing up that line with what I have from that only.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems he was interested in something, just not particularly in the same thing other students were. It's not that he's saying he was bored entirely. He's saying I was never interested in that.
Yeah.
So it sounds like he's under challenge.
That's right. And again, I'm going to put up another one here that we kind of have hinted at. It was also a separateness. Right? He's separate, and there's a separateness that he's distancing himself from the others. We have a lot of those ways of saying them. I only flagged it to make the point about when do we know, you know, we're stopping, and it's when we can start asking those questions. Is that helpful, you know, to add another label that isn't actually, that he doesn't say.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. So I'm not going to say, I don't want to make
you much. I'm trying to look at it from sort of the education perspective.
Yeah. And when you put your analysis back within a theoretical umbrella like that, or, you know, then it would make complete sense to be saying, perhaps this is connected to that whole notion of,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and that would be, make a lot of sense. Okay. So when we start like this, we get a nice mess. And but it's really great. I mean, obviously we haven't got a lot of trouble finding things to say in one paragraph about it. Then you get to the next stage in your analysis, your decision making stage. You have to make something organize this kind of stuff. And this is where I find it can be a very painful, slow process, because what we have here is first on the first pass. We might want to go through and say something like, is this am I describing or explaining something with this particular term? And if I'm just describing something, what are the actual words in the text that I can find relate to that? Okay? So can somebody just grab one for me that they want to pick, talk about?
I said he was defensive.
Okay.
And something that I found was he said that I think all people do it when he was talking about daydreaming, so that tells me that he is defensive about it.
Okay. I think all people do it. Okay.
I reference comments to me like that just in regard to opinion as being valuative. I didn't necessarily see them as being defensive, but there are a couple times where he is saying something, but he puts it in a evaluative statement or a evaluative perspective where it's, well, I'm not sure, but this is what I think.
Yeah. Okay. I'm with you. How could we contrast that? So with what I'm trying to say, what are some other interpretations? Okay. Besides saying, I think all people do it, we could say that's being defensive. We could also say using that phrase is...
I use that same term for rationalize.
Okay, rationalization, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Normalizing.
Normalizing, yeah.
You're the
fault.
Okay. So I use it for the same.
Okay.
The energy people.
Okay.
Normalizing?
Normalizing.
Yeah.
I think that's...
Normalizing. Yeah? Normalizing. Do we have that?
No, we don't.
Do you ever try and bracket it in terms of what he is not? Like, he's not insecure?
Thank you. Yes, thank you. That's the next thing, is to say what that's not telling us, or what he's not telling us, okay, that we might have expected to hear. Sometimes brings up.
You know, something that interested me was that he never spoke of his feelings in the paragraph. Like, he spoke of all these horrible perceptions he had of being left out, but he never said, I feel sad.
He wasn't particularly in touch with him. Mm-hmm. Didn't articulate
it. It doesn't seem to be any fear or insecurity either.
Okay.
I thought the term, I wasn't really in class with the embodiment.
This one?
Did you read them for phrases?
Oh, okay. We'll take it. Well, we could do more on this one, but let's move on for a minute, because it's, yeah, that's fine. So embodiment came from...
I wasn't really in class.
Right. Really in class. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're all coming at different aspects of the same sort of thing. Calling it different things.
Yeah, but in regard to that one quote, I wasn't really in class. I don't know, I think embodiment, physicality, position, space.
They could be. And this is again how one can start to link themes, right? That, and I can see why this could perhaps have been a larger concept. You might have linked some themes into a larger overarching concept of embodiment, which gives you lots of opportunity because it's an existential component of self. It gives you a lot of potential to talk about this, not really being in space and time and consciousness. All those things would come up if your concept is embodiment under those different themes.
Mm-hmm. Then doesn't me versus them fall within that?
It could. And as could then pronoun versus difference. But you would want to decide, you'd want to make a decision whether you want to treat that as a separate theme, okay, or lump it all in. Okay. It may well be that it becomes what emerges from this is you want to make the whole analysis or paper, the point of the paper, embodiment. In which case you would then have different themes feeding into that notion of embodiment. Maybe what's normal or different would be a theme. What's physical would be a theme, right? What's physical, under physical theme would be things like pain, maybe. Mm. You can see how they could fit. And you'd maybe have five or six themes that would all link up to your overarching concept of embodiment is what's going on for us. One possibility. Okay. Different one again, different kind of can you see another concept here that you feel is really moving above the level of just describing?
I worked on identity.
Yeah, identity. Same idea. Okay. What kind of identity then?
And actually the whole process of personhood and the one really one that stuck out for me was when he said not really a person, when you're being labeled and the whole self versus other, and the whole thing is about him trying to come up with his own identity and define himself. I guess the in relation to what we were just talking about before, the I, he was trying to figure out who he is.
Yeah. Okay.
Was he trying to figure out?
I think that the my interpretation of it was that the present him was trying to figure out who he was then and who he is now. That was where I was looking at it. Was that with through objective? Because he was looking at himself as being objectified. He
so
wasn't
maybe
a person.
Here, I'm going to put them in boxes just to separate them. But different themes again feeding into identity, right? You've got
pretty self-aware or self-conscious.
Self-aware.
Yeah.
Or self-confident at times in his dream state, at least.
Is that if we don't have that down, do we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The old people and the otherness. Where's the other?
It's in the space and condition of the body.
Oh, yeah.
I suppose in a way you can link authority to identity. Because
okay.
He knew who he was in relation to others and just didn't care for it.
And separateness too.
Yeah. Very good. And yet, as you can see, once you start to do work on it like this, you can start to make decisions where things don't necessarily combine anymore. Like authority perhaps in a way doesn't really combine into embodiment. In the way we were discussing, you know, in the way that it hangs. So you know that you can feel more confident. You found a different area, different kind of thematic area to build a concept around. Okay? That's good. A lot of us can do this sort of work. I think what I feel happens is having the real confidence in your own judgments and decisions that you make. So I guess what I'm trying to do is give you some perhaps just give strategies and things you can hang on to, questions you can ask yourself about the data as you're going along, just to help that confidence process. So the first one I want to do is to say, okay, I always try to make sure we stay very close to the data itself, right? So if I'm going to do something like, if I'm going to put something down like loneliness, isolation here, I'm going to want to know where exactly in the text that's coming from. One of the places, yeah, I have this
all the kids.
The same idea of saying you're not really a person. I was suggesting that for me that led to a sense of isolation. But you have to remember where I got there was indirectly, right? And he's not saying I was isolated or I was lonely. But the implication is that he was.
Well, he does say he was in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Good. The isolation, right?
Right, yeah. And he certainly made enough separation of I'm not like others, and I'm. But it's definitely going to an interpretive level, right, to call that loneliness or isolation. So I know that this is not a description anymore. It's not a description, it's a conceptualization, it's an interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have to go back and say, where are the themes that are going to support this? And they're here, we've got some. But I know what I'm dealing with, that I've got to be careful that this is not the pure descriptive level.
I'd say loneliness is phenomenological, but isolation would be more descriptive, though, because he says all the kids were interested in competing, but like he explicitly says, I am separate from all the kids, so
okay.
That fits in isolation.
Very good.
Separate from everybody
else. Very good.
Else.
So we could make a case to label a theme isolation.
But loneliness is interpreted.
Would be interpreting the isolation. Exactly. Very good. That's the number one point to make to you, because the number of times people get in trouble because they go to this level too soon. And then they start using this level as if they are themes. Okay? As if they are real things in the text. That's where you get in trouble, because when you go back, you can't find it. Right? So it's always being careful to question yourself about that. That's the first kind of pragmatic thing. The second thing I think Marty raised already, which is important and helps me, is to ask what is being denied by certain assertions that's in that story? What's being denied? Or what other plausible world or version of the world is at issue? Okay, from what? Ed is offering. Now some of you had said that an important one obviously is what our stereotyped perception of being retarded is. So right away Ed is doing things that are contrary to that, as we said, being coherent, providing a sense that he is self-aware, that he is a renegade. Now those ideas feed into that notion already, right?
Or what if Ed was an immigrant?
Right.
And his problem was a language barrier. Mm-hmm. Just thought of that.
It could be. But again, that would be
what if.
That's beyond the realm of the data. Yeah. So are we getting a sense of the difference between an interpretation and just a kind of guess? No? It's very hard. This is a fine line, isn't it? It's very hard. So I tell you why guess is maybe a bad word, but let's say why we would have trouble with that interpretation, that Ed may have language problems that come from a different background. Why would we have problems with that as an interpretation?
There's nothing specific to back it up.
There's no theme, right? There's no set of words in here, units of words or meanings in here that we can combine, or we could pull together to back up that interpretation.
There's not really anything to say the contrary either, though.
No, but then that leaves everything open. Maybe Ed is a pig and not a person. Right? So we can't go that far either.
Speculate.
Yeah. That's the word we wanted, speculate, as opposed to interpret. Mm-hmm. Okay, well done, thank you. That's the word I was looking for. So you're right, but then anything's open. So, you know, so that's why I would say stay very, very much to the text and the data. And if you're not sure, then don't, then just put it to the side, right? Your goal here is not to find every single possible thing imaginable in that story. You're trying to illuminate a particular phenomenon, right? And you're trying to do it in a way that's credible. So why would you want to go off on a tangent, knowing that you're not going to have that credible stance necessarily, both in what's particular in terms of the data to support it? Okay, let's go to another. So I do that, and then the third level of which I try to work is to look at those types, type 1, 2, and 3, and say, where am I in my thinking? Okay, well, if we can do that with some of these concepts. So let's start off with our embodiment. So if I'm working on embodiment as a concept, where am I situating myself epistemologically?
Type 3.
In the narrative. Type 3? Why would you say that?
Because it's not directly part of the subjective experience. You're putting an interpretation on it.
Okay, but that's still type 1, okay? The all of the subjective interpretations.
It's type 1?
Yeah. Because we're still trying to understand what the thing means. We're still perceiving the thing. Your perception of it's still the thing perceived. Right? Ed has... we're never going to know how Ed perceived the thing.
But he never talks about his physique or how he feels about it, but he makes lots of references to embodiment.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But when we're making a subjective interpretation of what meaning exists in Ed's text, we're staying in type 2 analyses. Another way to think about it is this is a phenomenological issue. It's an existential issue. It's pretty easy when you get into anything existential related to being, right, related to what it means to exist. And a perception of what it means to exist, you're in type 2. Solid ground.
Okay, but how is that type 1 then?
Oh, did I say type 1?
Yes.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I meant 2, sorry.
Okay.
I meant 2 all the time, sorry. Because you said 3, didn't you?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm really losing it.
No.
Okay. Sorry, I meant 2 all
okay.
the time.
Okay, no, I was like, how are we going back to 1? That was all I got.
I said 2.
Did you
know
what?
No.
1.
Oh, okay, I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Could you not look at type 3 if you're looking at the relationship between himself and his teacher and how he and himself
Very
versus the person who's interviewing him?
Very good. What's interesting about this one is that you can be in type 2 or you could take a type 3 epistemological
mm-hmm.
approach, okay, position to looking at identity in that story. You could take either. So you could treat it very much as this notion of perception. And I'd say this quotation here, not really a person, that's obviously really tells you you're situating yourself more in phenomenology, right? What it means person rather than being a person. But the authority brings up the possibility to look at the power relation that Ed's discussing and what his comment on that is. He's clearly seeing that the teacher is in a more powerful position. So what function is that serving? What meaning do we get out of that by putting it the way he did?
Well, there was someone in authority that power over him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Power over defining who he was.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The power to impose an identity
mm-hmm.
on him. Now, can you see how that's going more into the performative action?
Mm-hmm.
That the talk is doing for us. It doesn't mean it's not subjective experience too, because type 3 always is going to incorporate type 1 and type 2. It's got to use that as its raw material, right? That's where it came from.
Would it be type 3 as well, the fact that he sort of makes those justifications in, as he's speaking?
Very good. Okay. Yes, yes.
Okay.
Whenever anyone's, these are other clues to type 3. If someone's apportioning blame,
mm-hmm.
Okay. If someone's creating a morally tenable position for themselves.
Okay.
Those are very, very good clues that you're starting to look at the performative action of the talk or text. Apportioning blame or responsibility for creating morally tenable positions. Okay. Issues of power. They're often taking you into type 3 realm of thinking about more and more discursive analysis of the talk. Another possibility for type 3 could be to look at the metaphors and imagery purely as what the purpose they're serving and how they're framing things. For example, I could argue that I'm getting at that the idea of masculinity in that story because the imagery or the metaphors and imagery he's using are very masculine in orientation.
Mm-hmm.
I could also argue that there's a lot of the metaphors and imagery are also very, they're framing Ed's story in such a way that it's hard to walk away from it without feeling conflict and pain. You know, we're battles, we're cowboys, Indians, we're pain, we're sty in the eye, the text has its performative action has an unsettling or makes you uncomfortable. It's unsettling or uncomfortable. Mm-hmm.
In regard to the masculinity of the battles and cowboys and so forth, I can see it, but at the same time, in being labeled, in being the one that's considered the other, he. In essence, by the group, is given the effeminate role.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a tension there between him looking at himself in the masculine and the group looking at him in the feminine.
Well, very, very good. Very good, because I was just about to tell you that another area for type 3 is when you start to look at tensions and contradictions. And what you try to do within that is go to the ideological level that those are competing at. So you just gave a perfect example of that. If masculinity is apparent in the metaphor, what ideology would that be linked to? Or what competing, even if you don't get as far as ideology, just think of it as, think of it as an ideology, but think all ideologies have a dilemmical, either opposite or you can have more than one competing ideology, right? But most cases with our dualistic society and so on, we have two. We have a competing ideology. So where you have masculinity, you're going to have femininity. Okay? And how is that manifesting itself in Ed's story? Those are type 3 questions to ask in the data and to look for in the data. So it's not always cut and dry, okay? I'm trying to make it I'm oversimplifying it a little bit tonight to help us see where we would be. But you see how easy it is to oscillate and get lost a little bit? Where you are and why you got to keep hanging on to the epistemology at the end of the day, or else you really will get lost in this minefield. And as long as you know that's what you're interpreting and that's where you're coming from in the interpretation, then everything else can fit into the puzzle, including your ability to justify why you're interpreting it the way you are, including your ability to be credible and so on. Okay? But as soon as you start to step out of one area into another, and you don't follow along the full epistemology of it, then you get on shaky ground. Any other comments or subusing? The best way to know how to do this, of course, is to do it a lot, because it takes a lot of practice, but you get really good at seeing those connections after a while, much faster. And there is no real, there's no incorrect, there's just perhaps more plausible ways that you want to work with the data.
You started off mentioning that this is pretty easy to do, but I guess the trick is doing it in a way that's like, tr- credible word that you can substantiate in an academic journal of some sort.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the difference between a common layperson off the street reading Ed's story and telling us what Ed's talking about and us doing it. Okay? Otherwise, what would be the point? Because it's true, we all do this every day. We're making meaning and we're understanding what people mean every single day of our lives. There's no trick here, right? But what we're doing differently is we're doing it within our a theoretical understanding of what's going on. We're doing it within a way that's not supposedly self-serving, although I'm going to say supposedly, but we're doing it with the sense of which we're trying to get at meaning and all of its complexity and contradictions, and that we're acknowledging competing interpretations or possibilities. Those are the kinds of things that lay people aren't doing in everyday life usually, right? And then in doing that, we're able to pull out some pretty complex social, we're able to make a statement about a fairly complex social phenomenon. Right? If you think about it, at any level you chose to work at Ed's story, right from the, say, cultural level through down to the institutional level, through down to the completely phenomenological level of, you know, what it was like to be Ed, you're making, you know, pretty powerful, complex statements about processes, social processes that are going on. So that's why I like it, but it's not easy, that's me. Anything else? You did a really great job of pulling them out.
Where does the reflexive fit in when you're writing it up?
Thanks. It's the bottom of my page, that's where. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's see now if we can make a list of the things that could have influenced our interpretation.
Oh, hold on. Oh,
you want to?
You're going to send that out to everyone, right?
Well, Sean's not here, right?
That's it.
I've never seen that done.
And that's one pass. I mean, the other point to make is that this kind of team analysis we would do it over sessions, right? This is one pass at it. And we would get into layers and we would think about it and we would be regrouping themes and we would be changing some of our labels. We'd say, you know, I don't think we should call that objectification. I think that a better label for that would be, right? All that process would take place. But this is a good start. Somewhere. And look how much have I convinced you now about how much you can get, how much information you can get out of a paragraph. You don't need a 6-hour interview to say a lot about something. But we live in a world where more is better, right? It's true.
You can try to.
We think we got to interview, you know, 100 people to say something the first person probably told us. Okay, what influenced our interpretation? What kind of things could? I'm not saying they did yours, but what can influence our interpretation?
Personal experiences.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's a bit broad, but yeah. Okay.
Well, our own educational
yes.
experience at that age.
That's good. Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah. Okay, then we gotta have sex, then we gotta have, what else? Social class, right?
Caffeine levels.
We have to have the 1,000 demographic variables in the article Cheryl brought today.
Hmm.
Or social economic indicators, was it? 1,000 of them.
1,000.
Sorry about that?
No, I'm just. Mm-hmm.
Our own intersubjectivity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to just call that our own values, okay? Beliefs.
No more big words tonight.
It's getting late. Our beliefs, our attitudes, our prior experience, and with the experience one, both our real prior experience and our lack of is influencing, right? Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
The real lack of.
Perception of oneself.
Concept of self, yeah. Concept or identity, a sense of who we are. Here's the one I'm always referring to. It's amazing how we underestimate that one. Okay, but our confidence, our, I call it confidence, but really it's a type of anxiety of making that leap and making statements about the story.
That's where the caffeine comes in.
That's where the what?
Caffeine.
What else?
Confidence. Anxiety has a C, doesn't it?
Yeah. What about something like our political views? Mm-hmm. You think a conservative or a liberal might view that story differently?
I thought it was under like values or something.
Could be, yeah. Political values or values, yeah. Absolutely.
Experience within an educational context right now?
Yeah.
Or lack of it?
Marginalization.
Yeah.
Or level thereof.
Are you feeling marginalized, people?
No, I'm not, but that is, it, that does color my outlook on just about everything.
Okay.
Color your
right,
yeah. Good call.
Race, ethnicity.
The lack of it.
Race, ethnicity, or in any other way in which could be the disability.
How about the format this was presented in? Like if we had an audio tape of this and actually got some other impression due to some stutter that the transcription didn't pick up on.
The presentation of, in fact, what I had then was the relation between the interviewer and Ed, and particularly I want to look at it in relation to power, but what was that relationship, the social interaction that went on in the interview that created that story, right?
We are missing personality.
What did you say?
Personality.
Of the interviewer, or the
The one who is doing the interpretation, his or her personality.
Your own personality, and the interviewer's personality, I suppose. Yeah.
I
don't believe in personality, but if you'd like to, that's fine.
I mean, you could use things to measure it, like individualism versus collectivism, or masculinity versus femininity. So many ways to measure it, but whatever.
Okay, so you're thinking more about this set of characteristics that the interviewer presents at the time of the interview, or your own characteristics that you're bringing in to bear on your interpretation. Sorry. Remember, I am a social psychologist by training, so I'm always going to have a problem with a word like that.
Sexual orientation.
Yes, absolutely. Both gender and sexuality, sexes and gender and sexuality.
I don't know what to say, but I was aware of what you had told us about the transcription, and about sort of how guarded you were in telling us that he was labeled. You said it very carefully. So I don't know where that kind of, does it fit in? I mean, it did color what
absolutely.
I was looking at.
The fact that we knew that he worked as a janitor in a
There's a number of levels that we could talk about that on, but the pure fact that we are self-reflexive creatures, that we didn't work on that story and not think about anything except exactly interpreting that story. We thought, we were self-reflexive. We thought of ourselves doing the interpretation, right? The metacognitive level, right? We thought we did the interpretation, and then we thought about ourselves doing the interpretation, okay? Which is what I'm going to say, kind of remind me of what you said. You're thinking beyond. You're doing the interpretation, and you're thinking, but then think about how it was framed by. So it could be the self-reflexive that we're reflexive, but also I'll say you're right. It's how we. I'll just put that. Our frame of reference. How's that? Our frame of reference for approaching the account, right? That would fit better, maybe, with what you said, Fiona.
Is another way of saying experience real lack of simply accessibility.
Oh, I like that. That's a very underplayed one. Yeah, let me write that down. That's not talked about very much. That's a very important component of interpretive work and being able to be in that way.
Is the frame of reference synonymous with stereotype?
The frame of reference that you approach it with, it's not synonymous with, but it could well be that you had a stereotype that you were working from that formed your frame. I was using the case here where one of Fiona's frames of reference in approaching her interpretation was that I'd given a clue, she thought, or that there'd been an emphasis that I placed on the word labeling. That's not a stereotype, but that was how she, that framed or clouded, or not clouded, but set up a line of thought for her. Okay? So it could be stereotype, could be something else. Metaphors can frame experience, right? Can be a frame. So coming back more to here, I'm not quite sure I got that point about your experience. Do you remember it?
Well, if we have real experiences that parallel as or not, can influence the degree of empathy that we have with them.
Yes.
Or sympathy. No, empathy, because you actually can think that you feel that, you feel those emotions.
Yes, I'm so glad you made that distinction. Do you know how many people confound sympathy and empathy and don't really give them the separation that they need to have and that they do have? Yes, we can have, think about the empathy in dealing with that story.
That's one thing. But
very good.
I said accessibility, you said empathy.
So you're doing a great list. So already there's a lot of things at play. Not all of them are you ever going to write about or attend it, or you're going to dismiss some as not having been important. But some might ring a bell. Some might raise a flag for you. I immediately thought of when someone mentioned, which one was it?
Personality.
Yeah, experience and lack of. And I thought how much I was linking Ed's story to my ideas about about being a victim. I'm kind of on victimization these days, but it's just because I've been thinking about it in another context. But, you know, about the sense of which Ed was a victim and how much that would have been then framing a lot of the way I was seeing his story. And yet, if I back up from that for a minute, there's an entirely other line of thought about how empowering Ed's story is. But by being empowering, you could take it back again and say that by Ed's story seeming to be one where he's empowered, you could argue it all only emphasizes all the more the extent to which we victimize in our society. Because if he hadn't made that apparent, we might have just fallen right into the trap of poor Ed. Ed's story did more than make us go, oh, poor Ed. Do you see? So by being framed within an empowered notion of Ed, it challenged us to think about Ed not as just a victim, but on a different level beyond victimization. You're looking confused, Mr. Ed. Do you get it?
I was just thinking about, when we use the word victimize, is it used in any specific context, or is it just the general term for being a victim? Or, is it specific to some context?
Yeah.
This study, I think, that we were looking into, I think victimization meant bullying, basically.
Yes.
So, in this context, when you're saying victimization, is it something specific, or could be any type of victim?
Yeah. I wasn't thinking of it specifically.
Okay.
You could have thought of it as a victim of our educational system. You could have thought of it as a victim of that teacher's abuse. Yeah. So we'll leave that because it's a lot of things to do. But Cheryl, you want to take us into the next?